Is there anything you want us to not talk about?
Nope.
Really?
Talk about everything.
9/11, the Holocaust.
We can get gritty.
Definitely. Let's start with the Holocaust.
Start with the Holocaust.
Let's deny it to start with.
Yeah.
That's really good.
But he's the biggest revisionist I've ever met in my life.
I mean, I'm Jewish, so this works.
That's what they always say.
That's why we should start on it. I like fireworks.
Founders Ramble. Stories from entrepreneurs, how they started, why they started, and where they're going next. Brought to you by the Ministry of Startups.
Welcome along to Founders Ramble. My name is Vinny, and every couple of weeks, thereabouts, we do the Founders Ramble. Ben's not here, but his wholesome and manly, bearded, sexy stallion of a stand-in is here. It's Charlie. Hello.
Hello. Nice to be here.
Charlie is one of Ben's minions here in the Ministry of Startups. Sorry, that's not very nice.
No, minion works. Glorified janitor. What else? God knows. Handyman.
You're wearing a minion outfit anyway, so... You know.
Yeah, that works.
Good Lord. This is really...
And he's taken one of his eyes out just to...
Bit mental.
Every couple of weeks we do the Founders Ramble, and it's called the Founders Ramble because it's stories from startup founders. And as always, I'm joined with two today. One is George from Rentify, rentify.com, and the other one is Robin from weddingplanner.co.uk. And from their domain names, we can already learn a reasonable amount. As always, I know nothing about these gorgeous men, but I will dive in and find out what I can, and I'll start with you, George. George, you look quite young to start with. I mean, most startups are quite young people, but you look very young.
Thanks. I get ID'd a lot.
Yeah.
It's not very good. I'm 31. Does that surprise you?
Yeah, it does.
Does that actually surprise you?
Can we see some ID for that?
I actually don't carry ID. Like, this is the big problem. I have, like, in the last 3 weeks, I don't know. I should just clarify this. I've got no idea why I'm here. I was asked like an hour ago to do this, so I'm just going to just say things, and if it's wrong, you can tell me. But I get ID'd all the time, and I have like all these friends who have to buy me alcohol, like I'm 15.
But you do look like you can grow a good tash. Just the.
No, I just haven't shaved today.
Really nice tash and goatee.
Yeah, no, it just looks like I've dribbled food.
Yeah, that's the David Brent.
He's actually who I model my management style on. So yeah, so I'm not. I'm not actually that young, so I've got the dual horribleness of being old and young looking, whereas you'd rather be young and old looking, I think.
No, it's a win-win.
Is it?
Yeah.
You're keeping your youth.
There's a switchover, isn't there? Because when you're young, you really want to look old, and when you're old, you really want to look young.
But
you're probably on that switchover.
You guys have all got, like, your faces have been augmented by beards as, like, a cheap form of plastic surgery.
Yeah.
But I have a face, like, a little bit like a kind of a deep boiled action man, and I can't do what you've done there and change it, so it just looks stupid.
See if you should get like hair implants or something. One of my mates just got a hair implant. I wonder if you could get.
But they take it from the bum.
Do they actually?
They take it.
I don't have any hair on my
buttocks. Where it's taken from?
Butt cheek to chin.
Shut up.
Butt cheek to chin.
But
I don't believe that.
Or upper thigh. I'm told.
Upper thigh would. I could do upper thigh.
Oh, is this when they stitch it in?
Yeah, so they're removing follicles from one part of the body and then putting it somewhere else, right?
You're listening to Hair Cosmetic Surgery Special. Sorry, we've lost the point. Let's bring it back. George, it did start with a compliment and it went on a tangent.
Thanks,
you look
though.
Young, you're a beautiful man, but you're 31. You started a company. Are there any other co-founders?
There were, but like a black widow spider, after sleeping with them, I killed them.
Okay. Rentify. Rentify.com. What does it do?
We essentially, this is the least glamorous startup in London. But basically what we do is we have a Cox proportionate hazard model, which does, it looks at what we think a property will do on the market in terms of rent. And then we guarantee that price to a landlord before we've rented it. And essentially, I mean, if you wanted to be really blasé about it, and hopefully none of our VC investors are listening, we turn the property market into a big spread bet. And we bet on property prices.
Oh, okay. So this must mean that sometimes you get it wrong and you lose money because you guarantee a rent that you can't achieve.
We actually don't. That doesn't happen very often. So across the spread of our portfolio, so we have, I can't remember how many properties we have. We've got loads, but it's a self-managing leverage portfolio. We see a variance of about 1.8% against the price that we quote landlords. So sometimes we overachieve and sometimes we underachieve.
What's for the newbies like me? What's a self-managed variant portfolio?
Self-managed leverage portfolio just means we've got a lot of properties that are an app is basically telling us what to do. The robots are telling us how to do our jobs.
Ah, and so who made the robots? Did you make the robots?
I helped to make part of the robot. Actually, not even really. I had the idea for the robot, and then somebody else made it, and I'm waiting for someone to realize that I didn't make the robot. or for it to turn on
us. Well, we know that now, don't we?
Yes.
Are you the robot?
I'm not the people think I am a bit robotic, though. That comes across, doesn't it? That's really
maybe that's why you can't grow any hair.
That's probably exactly what it is.
So anyone listening to this is picturing a sort of mechanical Doogie Howser.
That's completely correct.
But a very well-spoken one. George, it sounds like you're university educated, if I may jump into the British class system for a minute.
Yes.
And what is it that you studied?
I read English literature because there were more girls on that course than there were on the computer science course.
Oh, you dirty, foul man. Should I say you clever bastard?
I know, that's an incredibly misogynistic thing to say. And it didn't actually do any good for me whatsoever because I pretty much didn't achieve anything at university in those terms. But no, I read English literature and then I came out and basically immediately started doing this.
A lot of people in the startup world have got a background in the corporate world and they just couldn't cope with it. They sat at a desk for so many years and feel so troubled inside that they said, right, hang on, I'd rather jump ship, earn less money, take more risks and live a different life. That doesn't sound like your story.
No, I moved house with a letting agent and I'm so myopic that I basically thought it would be easier to recraft the world around me than accept that some parts of life are a bit shit. And so I decided that I'd try and like destroy an entire industry because I was sort of annoyed with it. Like, I don't know if you know any letting agents, but they're all basically prats.
It's a total nightmare.
They're the thick children of rich people.
They're like that fly buzzing around in front of you.
I know. I don't know what that. I mean, I'm wearing my gym kit, optimistically thinking I might go to the gym at some point today.
They are a nightmare, though. And I'm sure everyone's got stories they can relate to. The last time I did it, I went to a letting agent, and he said that we looked at a property. It was great. And he said, OK, if you could just sign up for that for 3 years, and I need a letter from your employer. I'm like, right, first of all, I'd never at any point said I wanted a place for 3 years, and I'm self-employed. And he goes, oh, well, that's going to be difficult. At which point I went on Gumtree and found a private market. So can you rectify this bastard situation?
Yeah, we do. So for landlords, obviously the promise from us is that the landlord gets guaranteed rent for 1 to 3 years with no arrears, voids, repairs, dilapidations, anything to worry about. So they get a fixed income. And it works out way better for them. They make an extra 10% on what they would in the market. And then for tenants, we do things like we don't charge deposits for properties because we're insured, so what's the point in charging thousands of pounds for a deposit? We provide them with contents insurance, and when you sign up, you get asked what utilities you want, so if you want Sky Sports, BT Sport, Virgin Media, all that stuff. You pick it all through our app, and then we actually get it installed before you move in, and then we take it out in our name, so you're basically paying for it through your rent. But it means that when you want to move out, you just tell us, you don't have to faff around with it.
And so legally speaking, you're renting hundreds of properties.
We are becoming the biggest landlord in London without owning any property, and we're also one of the biggest consumers of media in London and utilities in London. We do the council tax, we do everything.
Your insurance sounds, I don't want to get all nerdy, and it could possibly be boring, so forgive me if I'm going down a dull cul-de-sac. But I'm worried, your insurance must be really complicated, because if one of your tenants, I don't know, accidentally sets something on fire and needs to claim, then you technically are the insurance holder, but you didn't do anything wrong.
So we have, I'm trying to think about how, if it's possible to answer this without like giving away trade secrets. Basically, we are, the broad strokes of it are that we are.
You can just say it's magic if you want.
We are the landlord of the property legally, and we are not the tenant of the property, but we are able to, if you don't want to be FCA regulated and you want to do insurance things, basically as long as everybody is getting the same deal, you can make sure that you're covered. And so we have about 7 or 8 different insurance products that apply to all of our properties. Yeah. And then sometimes we give tenants the option of paying for them. So for example, all of our properties have accidental damage cover from tenants. And sometimes we say to tenants, do you want to pay for accidental damage cover? But they all have accidental damage cover.
Ah, gotcha. Yeah.
But it is a complex vehicle, as our lawyer put it.
I think London for everyone is anyone that earns any money will notice that more than 50% of that money goes on rent. Is there anything that you and your organisation can morally do to just stop what is a train that's out of control called high rents?
Well, I was at a government round table thing a few months ago, which is just like, these things are so dull. Basically, the only thing, they were all asking, like, what are the technological solutions that you can come up with for this? And it's really simple. So since 1980, we haven't built enough new dwellings in this country. right? So every single year we have a target for the number of new houses we need to build, and every single year successive governments, doesn't matter whether they're Conservative or Labour or Coalition, they fucked it up and not built enough houses.
Yeah.
And so I was...
And if you listen between the coughs of Theresa May the other day, you might have noticed that one of her policies was to build a staggering 5,000 houses a year.
Remarkable.
Thanks for that.
Yeah, the additional liquidity into the market will really move the needle for people who are living like seven to a house. But I mean, so you've got that at one end of the spectrum, and then at the end of the spectrum, you've got Jeremy Corbyn saying that he's going to introduce rent caps. And I think it was Paul Krugman who said, you know, the Nobel Prize winning economist who said, other than bombing, the best possible way to destroy a city is rent control. Because we have, you know, it's we have an invisible hand in the market that's guiding things, supply and demand, market liquidity. This is the way that markets work when there is an imbalance of supply and demand. And so we need to introduce additional liquidity into the market. And some estimates put it, you know, you could introduce 20% more dwellings into the London market and you would still have a one-to-one ratio of people to houses.
Yeah.
It's crazy. So the only thing that we can do is what we continue to do, which is to go to all of these stupid government events where they say, what can you do with an app to improve things, and say, stop fucking around with apps and start building houses.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry, that's a bleak answer.
No, I'm really, I share your passion as someone that forks out pretty much every penny he possibly has on rent and lives behind a train line and in front of what can only be described as an ambulance superhighway and has mice. So if you notice that I'm angry, it's because I haven't slept for about 3 weeks.
Well, are they your mice, or are they like...
They've become my mice.
They're unwelcome mice.
Yeah. No, I'm now so friendly with them that I've got... it's Mickey and Mindy. I mean, it's not very original, but they are quite pet-like now. Although, having said that, given the chance, I would bludgeon them to death.
Really?
Yeah. They keep me up, mate.
But, okay, yeah, okay.
Brutal. Not in a good way.
They eat your food.
Your body language
they
changed.
They eat my food.
All of the love drained from his eyes then.
He I despise them.
Yeah.
And it's destroying my relationship with my girlfriend.
Do you know what you can...
Because she despises them even more.
Do you know what
I thought
can
we
do?
Weren't getting onto the personal issues.
Yeah. Also, when I was a child, I was...
Put down, there's these sticky traps that you can get. I think you might have to have a license to buy them, but if you go and there's a shop on Upper Street where they'll just give you whatever you want, basically, any kind of chemicals. But there are these sticky traps that you can get where you put it down and then the mouse will step on it and, like, it has to gnaw off its own foot in order to get off it.
And get stuck. I've used these. Yeah, they are brutal as hell. And like
you have to gnaw off your own foot?
No, you just find these half-dead mice attached, stuck by one limb. No, can't get off.
That. People on the internet don't like you if you use them. So we don't. I have never used them, but I've used them and they're great. They are great for catching mice. They're really amazing. I had this guy came to my house to build. He was building a walk-in wardrobe because I'm very firmly a member of the 1%. And he went. He was this Polish guy. And he goes into my room and he came out. I was sort of there because I didn't really know him that well. And he came out and he said, "I make a toilet." And I was like, fuck, he's made the wrong thing in my bedroom, or he's done a big shit on the carpet.
Yeah, and both of these things don't sound that good.
It turned out he just needed to use the bathroom. But he went into the bathroom and he saw the mouse traps that I had in there, and he was like, it's no good. And I was like, what do you mean? And he went out and he got these things for me, and he showed me, I have this little puppy, and he said, he explained to me that if my dog, he visually explained this to me, if my dog touches this mat, he was like, leg off, leg come off.
Right.
I was like, okay, cool. So, yeah, but they are really effective. So get some.
I don't know if I can morally cope with that.
But do you have traps?
Yeah.
Same difference,
yeah,
really.
Fair enough.
It's a slow death.
I've got poison as well.
Poison's even worse.
And one of those things that you plug in the wall that makes noises. That
they don't do anything. There's no scientific basis to think that they work. They don't do anything.
50 quid!
There are no mouse droppings. It's probably a 30 centimetre radius around my plug-in device, and there are no mouse droppings around that. So
have
like,
you got mice as well?
Yeah. Everyone's got bloody mice.
See, this is the thing. I've been living in Canada for 12 years. You know what? No mice. Come back here. It's like a fucking Dickens novel.
But why are there no mice in Canada?
Because it's probably just too cold.
Yeah.
Yeah. Also, there's not that much culture, so maybe. Sorry, Canada. You did me very well. All right, moving on. Robin from Wedding Planner, we've been ignoring you somewhat. Tell me about your business, weddingplanner.co.uk. First of all, fairly obvious what you do, fantastic domain name. How did this begin?
So I started a music agency at uni. That was pretty much just providing live music for events around the country, a lot of which were weddings. So that's what got me into the wedding space. Mm. And now I'm still not married. No plans to get married anytime soon, but I've managed to land myself in the wedding industry, trying to see what technology can do to sort of sort out some of the issues.
Maybe that's why you're not married, because you know just how much shit goes into a wedding and how much difficult it can be.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I think I've put my girlfriend off for life. She's no interest in getting married, so mission accomplished.
If you're listening, darling,
that's it.
I love you dearly. All right, so you started... Well, how did you make that transition from the music world into wedding planning then?
So we even though that it's called wedding planner, we're not actually wedding planners. So it's essentially the site enables couples to plan and book their suppliers through the site. So they've got planning tools. They can search for suppliers by price and availability. It's I could see what was going on out there, the other platforms, because I used to list my own business on these other sites, and they were just sort of your typical directory listing model. They weren't doing much with technology, and actually, arranging a wedding seems to be such a minefield for so many couples. Actually, it doesn't need to be that hard.
Traditionally speaking, I suppose everyone does everything completely independently. So I'm going to get my DJ by Googling the DJ. I might grab Yellow Pages for, I don't know, the caterers. Oh, my friend John does
and
whatever
magic.
It might be. Magic, yeah. And then the florist down the road, I like her. And so this mishmash. Are you saying that you're more of a one-stop shop?
It's very fragmented. So yeah. as you're saying, like you're getting a mixture of recommendations, finding people online, wedding fairs, and so you could do it all through Wedding Planner. Yeah, you could say in some ways we are one stop shop, but we're not mad to think that actually brides are perennial browsers. They just want to see inspiration, look at real weddings from all over the place. They're all sat at their computers at work, pretending to work, and they're actually just looking at like wedding dresses and stuff. So the reality is, it's always going to be tricky to try and get a couple to find everything in one place, just because they'll like looking around. But actually, in terms of managing that whole process, there's limited tech out there to sort of help with that. You're finding, negotiating, contracting with 15, 20 different suppliers. You've never booked anything like this before. So actually to be able to do it all in one place.
And read reviews, presumably?
Yeah, reviews is obviously a big
because I think that's the minefield
well.
For a lot of people, isn't it? They're like, I think I need a catering company. These guys look good, but they could be cowboys. They might turn up with 2 Brussels sprouts and charge me 10 grand. So
that's not magic.
the reviews are a big part, definitely. But the big thing for us, which we was what we really started out with pushing, was this whole finding suppliers by price and availability. So, if you Google photographers in Surrey, you get a million results of loads of photographers, but you've no idea who's available on a date of your wedding or what it's going to cost you.
Right.
So what you've suddenly got to go through and contact all these photographers. For a lot of the photographers who can't do it, it's a waste of their time. For you, it's a waste of your time. If you can already filter that out, you know, that price and availability functionality, it's just the suppliers like to keep everything sort of hidden away. So there's a real lack of transparency in the industry. Yeah. And that's what we're sort of trying to bring.
So does that mean that, let's say I'm, to use your example, a photographer in Surrey, have I got to keep you in the loop of my bookings? Have I got to do a live booking through your site regularly to make sure that...
Yeah. How does the user like journey work from start to finish, running through?
So the
Fair question, Charlie.
From a supplier perspective or a couple's perspective?
Let's plan a wedding.
Should we plan a wedding?
Vinny and I are getting married.
Right.
Bridal groom.
Thank God. That's the only reason I set up this podcast.
It can be groom and groom, you know. It's
groom. It's all, exactly. Okay. Vinny and I are getting married.
Yeah, it's the new world, mate. Why does one of us have to
leave
suddenly...
It now.
This is our first couple's tiff. Yeah, all right.
First of many.
My TR agent is just like picking up a phone right now. Oh, wait, this isn't live, so they can't be doing it.
What the fuck have you gotten yourself into?
I like pianos. Can we have a live pianist, please?
Yeah, that sounds good. Where the hell do we find one?
Well,
you know
my friend recommended weddingplanner.co.uk. Let's have a look
online.
I heard that's a great site. Oh, I'm on the site now. Hey, honey. This pianist said he's available next May when we're getting married, and he's only £200. Should we go for that one?
Yeah, let's do that. And what else can we find?
I'm a little bit worried about one thing, Charlie Honey Bunny. The pianist, did he recently log on to Wedding Planner to update his calendar? Is this information reliable? I'm a little worried.
Well, you'll have to ask the pianist, won't you? So that's the reason there aren't booking systems at the moment on other sites in the wedding industry is because if you imagine like booking a hotel on booking.com or something like that, you'll see the room, you'll see pictures, and you want to book. Booking wedding suppliers, it's like building a relationship. So you build the relationship, you inquire to the supplier, you build the relationship with them both on and offline, and then you come back and book it and manage it all in one place once you've agreed what you want to
book. Got it. Okay, so that's my frustration taken away. We don't book him here and now, we can put the request in now, and then if there's any information that's not happening, we can get that at a later date. But this was an easier way to find my pianist, I did say pianist, than any other way. So what's the sort of limit on suppliers? Can I get caterers, people to cover my chairs, musicians?
Caterers, venues, yeah, bands, photographers, videographers, I mean, and then, wedding dresses.
And then how does it all come together? Are you given like a login to like the back end where you can see like various bits of it all piecing together?
So the couple have access to their own set of planning tools, completely free, and they've got a checklist there which is recommending what they should be doing when they should be doing it.
Timelines.
So we know you're this far out from your wedding. Have you got this booked yet? If not, why not take a look at these suppliers?
Oh, nice. Definitely don't start with the pianist.
No.
Yeah, you wouldn't normally start with the pianist, but you could, you know, like you can start with whatever you want.
Okay.
So you've got they can track it all from managing their budget, their guest list, all of that within the tools.
Okay.
And that's normally how couples come to us initially. They're initially sort of looking for a wedding planner or planning tools. They sign up. And then they start their journey through the site.
Charlie and I have had a very large argument recently about the tables. I want them from a particular supplier that you've referred me to on your website, and
right.
He wants them from another. But there's just so many questions. Do we talk to you about the finite questions, or do we go to those suppliers?
All between the suppliers, between the suppliers and the couples.
Can we get the information from your website?
Yeah, so all the information, well, that the suppliers make available is obviously there on the website.
Uh-huh.
But
so Charlie, we can phone them and sort that out, okay?
We can phone
Bunny?
Sort it out.
You can go see them face to face, you
know.
Have a cream tea.
I suppose this then brings the question, how do you make your money?
So at the moment, it's the traditional sort of listing model or lead generation. So every time you send an inquiry to a supplier, that supplier's charged. But we're now moving towards us taking a percentage of the actual booking. So now couples can book through the site, and we take a percentage of that booking.
Got it. George, talking about funding now, how did you start Rentify financially? Did you have to put any of your own money in?
Yeah, I did. So I put in, it wasn't an awful lot in the grand scheme of things. I mean, we've been really lucky with funding. So we basically, I sent an angry email about renting a place with a letting agent to a friend of mine, who forwarded it on to a guy who had just sold his business, who took us to lunch and basically, over the course of a burger, said, I'll give you £25,000 to just start this. And then we said we needed 50, and he took us to some other people who we took the rest from. And then over the course of about a year, we raised £500,000. Wow. Then we raised £2 million. Then we raised £11 or £12 million the year before last. And we'll raise probably 15 next year. So we're just like, We've been really, really fortunate to have a big market and a big opportunity that hasn't been tapped.
How did you manage to get all this money?
How did
you raise it?
So I met a VC who I knew that I needed to raise from some VCs, because I just knew that venture capital was what everybody did in the startup world. And so I sent an email to one of them saying, I'm going to go meet every VC in London this year, and you can be the guy that I just blow it on. You can be the guy that I just like fuck everything up with. And then they turned out to be our principal investor.
Amazing.
That's a brilliant tip.
So
I don't know if it's always going to work.
That's a good
but it's gutsy and it's excellent.
So we're kind of going through the process of shifting from being a series A, B kind of company to a growth stage company. So this year we'll probably do $7 million of recurring revenue this year, and then next year slightly more.
You said you're on track to be the biggest landlord in London. What's the
ambition? We want to be one of the biggest landlords in London. It depends on how you quantify it, because some people have properties on their balance sheet. Some people just, there's a whole bunch of different ways of doing it.
Yeah.
The vision for us is that we want to get to 100,000 units under management worldwide, and we want to be in three territories at least, so London, probably Berlin and New York. And so the plan for us is basically next year we'll start on an international territory. But we've been through, so in terms of sleepless nights, in terms of funding, not so much. But we started with a model that just fundamentally didn't work. And we raised a bunch of money to do that model. We launched it in 2012. We got to 2014 and we realized this wasn't working.
What was wrong with that model? It was just in brief, if you don't mind.
Basically just a shit way of making money. We wanted to provide software services to help landlords be better landlords. And actually, most landlords are kind of comfortable with being bad landlords. Yep. And so that was not a good way of making money from them. We were trying to get people who spent no money to spend some money. And now we get people who are spending lots and lots of money to spend slightly less of money.
Right,
with us.
Much better model for everyone
involved
in the whole chain.
Yeah.
But that's amazing, because a lot of people after that couple of years would have gone, this is rubbish, I'm going to go and keep sheep in Guam. Probably not. I don't know if there's any sheep in Guam. But my point is...
moving to Fiji.
Sheep in Guam.
Yeah. Goats in Fiji. You see the point.
Exactly, yeah.
Would have tried something completely different. You pivoted and changed the model and changed...
Well, I think it sounds really similar. You know, there's you kind of get this sense that there's the smell of a good idea in a space. And I think, like, listening to how you've described your business with weddings, you know, there are parallels there with what Zoopla and Rightmove did, where they came into a fragmented market, they control and consolidate all of the traffic into one side of a marketplace, and then you can dictate terms to the second side of the marketplace. That's a slightly brutal way of putting it, but you know, and actually the minutiae of how you deal with that, whether you're charging a percentage or whether you're charging on a per lead basis, those things don't matter so much. What matters is that you know you're in a big broken market, and you know, the wedding market in the UK is huge, like the lettings industry. You know, this is a £40 billion market, and so in London alone, you know, there's 1.25 million rental properties. So it's like, it's a crazy huge market.
Yeah. Try not to be too English and modest about this. How did you get the balls to play with these massive figures and do something so ambitious?
I mean, like, I don't know.
Because it is remarkable. A lot of startups, like, I get scared when I buy a new printer, you know. It is my money, admittedly.
And it's a big printer.
It is a big printer.
Is that the one downstairs?
Fucking expensive.
Yeah, that's a really good printer.
Yeah. But I still got scared buying it, whereas you seem to be playing with these enormous figures very casually.
You're asking George why he's so blasé with other people's cash.
Yeah. No,
do you think that's...
it's a good question. It's a good question. I come across as being very blasé, but I can assure you I'm not. But there's a, I can't remember what the management paradox is, but it's basically in a meeting where you have to have like a committee decide on whether or not they should build a nuclear power station, and then also where the tool shed for the nuclear power station should go. The big imponderable thing of the nuclear power station takes like 10 seconds to decide, and then the committee will debate for hours over the tool shed. Mm. And it's kind of the same thing with us. Like, it just seems like it's so straightforward to, you know, in isolation, we have really high confidence levels in our model to be able to say, this property is worth 2,000 a month, guarantee it and underwrite it to the landlord. And you sort of zoom out and look at the whole rent book and think like, oh my God, we're running a really, really big portfolio here. But we've been really blessed to have amazing people working on it. You know, we've got some of the like some really sharp economists and some really sharp data scientists and some of the best people in technology, and you know, people from Goldman Sachs and all these people giving us their time. And so, it's almost no accident. It's almost nothing to do with me. I mean, in fact, it's almost like if you took me out of the company, it probably would have scaled years ago.
See, remember the try not to be too English and modest, and he finishes with, to be honest, it's nothing to do with it. It would have happened anyway.
Yeah.
You are massively to do with it, and I think you should be quite proud of yourself.
Thanks.
How many people now work for Rentify?
Like 25 or 30? I don't know. Like, I should know that, but I don't.
That'll do.
It scales up and down.
When you're at that number, it tends to fluctuate a bit.
We want to kind of double over the next year, so I should probably get to grips with that.
People listening might
be... Can I ask, where's the... best place you've found in terms of hiring talent? Has it been a real mix of the team?
It's really hard. We really like working startups for kind of entry-level positions. So like, we have a lot of customer service people and a lot of sales people. We do a lot on Indeed. Boulderton also have an investment in a company that I can't remember the name of that I should, that's really useful. So just go on Boulderton's website and look for companies that do sort of vaguely job-related things. For software engineers, like, it's so hard. Because if you go down the road of having a recruiter do it for you, we kind of treat it as like you're bringing cancer into your organization, because you're bringing somebody in who is like, I'm unhappy, and in 2 years I might get unhappy and call a recruiter and say, just take me out of here. Mm-hmm. And so we try and look for people who are not coming through recruiters in software engineering.
How do you find them, though? Like, particularly
we sponsor a lot of events. So we sponsor
I'm going to get the name wrong. I think we sponsored
Silicon Milk Roundabout kind of thing.
We didn't do that. We did Girls Can Code. So we also have a real gender imbalance in our team, which is really annoying. I think we're no more than 70-30 male to female, and we really want to correct that. And so we sponsor a lot of events around getting women into STEM subjects and into engineering. The guy to talk to about this is our CTO, Edwin, who's fantastic at like all this sort of stuff. He's got his finger on the pulse with all the hiring websites. He's doing blog posts about what we're doing and all that stuff. I go in and just like put my head around the door and say, are you okay? You know, come and work here. And hope sometimes people decide to and sometimes they don't.
Do you have quite a difficulty then finding people for wedding planner?
Particularly in developers, you know, especially when it's, you know, it's not my background at all. And before we got on our CTO, who has his own software company. So at the moment, our development's outsourced, and we're now bringing in looking to bring it in house. But hiring's tough, especially when you almost don't really understand actually how your code's written. You're trying to go through connections. Who knows who is maybe potentially looking for a job, or rather than going through recruiters, but actually finding people who, you know, code in the languages you need and would fit in, you know, well with the team and are interested in our product as well.
It's a lot of variables to control, right? Because you've got people, you know, as you said, you've got to make sure, can they competently do the job? And then you're kind of also assessing, but are they really good? And then are they also a cultural fit? And then are they actually passionate about the company? We did exactly the same thing. We outsourced the company the first time. We basically got a 50K initial investment. And the first thing I did was sign a check for 35K to an outsource agency. And I was just like, oh my God, this is really nerve wracking. And we got super lucky with them and they were lovely. And then we brought in an engineer full time. And we got really, really lucky with the guy that we brought in, because he basically would sit next to me and he would basically take my crazy ideas. So I'm semi-technical, but I would say to him, like, we need to do something a bit like this. And he'd be like, I know, George, you're wrong, and I'll do it, and I'll show you why you're wrong. And he'd go away and do it. And we were so lucky with that, because he's probably a 7 out of 10 engineer, but a 10 out of 10 cultural fit, and somebody who was really, really able to work well. And it's just a really difficult thing to find. Because also, the other thing is, like, you're asking them to basically take a huge risk, because it's like, hey, we got, you know, 6 months of funding, and we're working on this idea, and maybe we'll get some more funding from our investors. Quit your job and come and join us. And if you go and get somebody who's just come out of university and say, hey, the wedding industry is broken, they think, I don't give a shit, I'm never going to get married or whatever, you know. Like, it's such a difficult thing. You think you've got to help with weddings. I mean, nobody wants to come and help landlords make an extra 10%.
Do you sit down in all the interviews still and try and get involved?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we regularly...
I should ask at that point, sorry, I didn't ask you, how many people work at Wedding Planner?
So we're six at the moment. Yeah. Finding good individuals for the roles so far actually hasn't been as tricky. But maybe that's because I understand their roles much better than I do. How developers work, what their needs are, what their background and often what their interests are as well. I'm trying as much as possible to try and relate really to, you know, what they might be looking for, what their requirements are, and how the wedding industry can be of interest to them.
There's one really cool thing that was like a hack. I can't remember who taught it to us, but we found it about a year and a half ago, and it's completely changed our hiring thing. This sounds like a BuzzFeed headline. But basically, the last thing that any hire at Rentify has to do, whether they're like coming in as chief operating officer or as like, an entry-level position, we will ask them to do... As a complete surprise, we will come in with a single sheet of paper for them, and we say, you have 5 minutes to prepare a 10-minute presentation to 10 people in the company that you haven't met before about a topic you're passionate about. It can't be about your family, it can't be about a football team, it can't be about going to the gym, and it can't be about travel. And those are the criteria, and you have to go and do it. And about 20% of people, it turns out, have no passion in their lives. They don't have a thing that drives them. They don't have a thing that they care about. They're not into needlework or poker or magic tricks or trainers or anything like that. And those people in general suck to work with, because they can't get passionate about anything. And then what happens is that these 80% of people give these amazing presentations about things that they really care about, that they're deeply, deeply, like, that is the thing that they wake up thinking about at the weekends and they're excited about. And even if they're not the right fit for the company, you have an amazing time learning about something for 10 minutes and you can ask them questions. But we found that really moved the needle on us because it opens people up and you can see them being animated and passionate about stuff. And, like, we do that so often. And it means that also that our team loves hiring now because we get to hear people talk eloquently or semi-eloquently about topics that are kind of interesting.
That sounds amazing. But just to play devil's advocate, although I actually do side on what you've just said, sometimes let's imagine that you're hiring a developer, a coder that's very much a solitary position that plays with code all day. Mm. Is it so bad if they're a little bit inward? Is it so bad if they're an introvert that can't do that presentation?
It's not a qualitative judgment on the standard of the presentation or whether they're introverted or extroverted. It's about whether or not they are capable of being engaged and passionate about a topic and then articulating it to other people. So with our software engineers, when they do this, they will talk about, they'll talk about spaces versus tabs in their code, which is like the big nerdy kind of debate, all right? Or maybe they'll talk about
10 minutes on that.
You could do 10 minutes on that. Like, you should be surprised some of the stuff I've heard. But the point is there something in their life that is giving them a sense of purpose and that they're passionate about and that they enjoy? And it's a commonality amongst everybody in our team. So if I think about our team, Ryan Harkins, co-CTO, plays guitar, loves it. Edwin Wills, DJs at like Ali Pali and all these amazing places. Gabrielli does loads of charity work. All of the people on our team have stuff that they drive and they're engaged with and they're passionate about outside of work. Mm. And they're the best people to work with because it means they automatically pass a whole bunch of tests. Like, you know, in the background, you're doing your due diligence on this person. They're just the best people to work with. And you can accept sometimes kind of not quite the highest standard of technical accomplishment if you've got somebody who's like a really great person to be around.
Do you think that might be helpful for you, Robin?
I can definitely see long term how that actually works really well as a strategy. I guess short term, if you need quick solutions to like issues around getting a developer in and actually get someone who can do the job, fits in, gets it, and there aren't other options.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
You've suddenly got to take the question going, okay, well, you know, what choice do you have?
Do you find it that hard to hire people then? Is there a shortage of decent numbers?
I think in terms of developers there are, but again, if I was more from that world, you know, maybe that wouldn't be the case. I don't know.
No, I don't think you would. We probably make offers on about 5 or 10% of the candidates that we interview. It's really hard. It's really hard. You know, I was talking to a friend's company that's probably Series D or E now a couple of years ago, and he said, I want to double the size of my engineering team, and I've wanted to double it for 2.5 years. You know, you're competing with, if you think about it, you're competing with DeepMind and all these other places. Like, Google will pay a signing on fee to an engineer, like a footballer. So if you go and join them on 100K a year, which nobody here is going to offer people, then after 12 months of service, they'll give you 100K as a bonus. Like, you just can't, can't compete. It's crazy.
And you're working for Google, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So you're getting stock bonuses that are literally like instant cash.
And it looks good on your CV.
And you're working for a company that...
All right. She's shitting all over us.
Come on, so who guys would want to work for bloody Rentify anyway?
But no, but you're right. There's all of these other competing things that are there. And you have to find people who are kind of crazy enough and passionate enough about what you're doing
Then focused a lot more actually on people at sort of that entry level and actually built sort of nurturing talent within the team rather than going out there and...
Absolutely. Across all of our teams, we don't look for people who are experienced and coming from big companies. So for our sales team, for example, we went through a whole phase of hiring letting agents, and it was rubbish because they're not a cultural fit. They're often not very bright, and it's just like, who wants to work with them? So now we look for people who've got a good degree from a shit university or a shit degree from a good university, and they've got team sports on their profile, right? So the head of our tenant sales team, he came over to the UK. He's the overseas pro for Woking Cricket Club, and he came over and just like is blow away. He's like so like impressive as a person. He'd never been a salesperson before, but you can start to identify what these kind of people look like. And so for engineers, our second engineering hire who's now at Deliveroo doing amazing things, he made a post on Hacker News that just said, email is broken and I have fixed it. And you click on this link and it's this just mental, like, red website with all this crazy stuff going on. And he'd open sourced the source code. We kind of looked at it and we were like, this guy's actually quite good. He's just a bit mad. And, like, he doesn't kind of, like, he can't present things or design things. And we sent him a message and he was about to go through clearing to go to university. And we just said, like, you can do that. You're going to have a rubbish time. Come and work for us and move to London. And so you can kind of build up profiles of people who are misfits. You know, it's like the Steve Jobs thing of it's better to be a pirate than join the Navy. All those people going to Google are just joining the fucking Navy. You want to find the people that are kind of like, they're building their own ships and maybe they're sinking, but you know, you want to come and get them to come and join yours. It's a very tortured metaphor, but yeah.
No, I liked it. I presume there must be some failure in it. Every now and then you must get a bad egg.
Oh yeah, we've hired some really shit people. I mean, marketing is a classic example. We've probably had 4 CMOs, none of whom have been good enough for us. But you do develop a point of view at a certain time as well, which is that there's no such thing as a bad person or a bad hire. You basically, there are people who aren't right for that role in that time. And there's, you know, that like some of the things that our marketing hires have gone on to do have been incredible. And they're just not quite right for our company for whatever reason. And so you do get it wrong a lot of the time. The other thing that we've changed is that we spend so much time referencing people. You give me 2 references, those are the 2 people that I'm not going to call or contact about you whatsoever. I'll go on LinkedIn, spend a couple of hours finding, really? We'll find 7 or 8 people that you've worked with above you, below you, and alongside you. And we'll phone them up and ask them, you know, what makes them throw their laptop across the room, what stresses them out, what's the
piece. And you'll do this without their knowledge, right? The candidate's knowledge.
We'll do it at the point where we know that we're not going to, they're not risking their job to do it. We'll just say, can we ask some people who know you? And so we'll then, we won't tell them who the people are. And if there are specific people they don't want us to contact, we ask them and they let us know. But we want to know basically, you know, at that point we know we want to hire this person, yeah, right? So we actually want to know what is the stuff that we need to manage with this person or help this person with. The best one is, what is the piece of feedback this person always gets but always ignores or doesn't act on? And that's such a telling thing.
What are you looking for? Or what are you not looking for, should I say?
Well, you're not looking for anything because you know that you want to hire this person. Unless every single person says, like, this guy sexually assaulted someone and we think he's going to do it again, then you know you're still going to hire them. But you want to know, you know, like, the piece of feedback I always get is he talks too quickly, right? Like, I mean, there's other feedback as well. Like, talks too quickly is not emotional, doesn't have good pastoral skills, all that sort of thing. And so you think, okay, well, I'm hiring this person. And so as a manager or somebody who's going to work proactively with this person, I want to immediately set them up for success by not putting them in a situation where they have to, like, confront their weaknesses and, like, do stuff that they're bad at. I want to help protect them so that they can actually, you know, succeed. And so finding out about people's weaknesses is really useful at that point. I don't know why we're talking about this, sorry.
No, it's good. We're just talking about screening. A really novel way of doing it. That's not what I expected.
People
I
really
expected
don't like
to
it.
Say at the beginning of this, I like Indeed, I quite like LinkedIn, I check their references. You absolutely do not do that.
The Financial Times wrote this up, like, our hiring methodology, and, like, I literally got hate mail from people saying, like, you are, like, subhuman scum.
Why?
The way you do this. Because it probably seems quite, like, evil and, like invasive and all sorts of things.
Oh, I don't know. I think you're just being transparent about what everyone does. They might not go to the point of phoning up their buddies on LinkedIn, but they certainly stalk them through Facebook and every other channel, look at their pissed up photos and go, is it all right to be naked at 4 in the morning? Yeah, I've done it. Let's hire them anyway. So don't you worry.
It's always all right to be naked at 4 in the morning.
I'd say it's obligatory. To finish up then, by the way, if you're wondering what on all this is, we're talking to George from Rentify.com and Robin from WeddingPlanner.co.uk. Robin, one of the things we quite often ask the founders during this podcast is, bearing in mind there's a lot of people in this building and various other Ministry of Startup buildings that have undertaken something that they sometimes feel like they've bitten off a little bit more they can chew. Have you got any advice for people on how to just chill and how to frame the beginning of their startup journey in a way that doesn't send panic into them? Is there any advice you can give to newbies that are setting up?
Someone said to me that, you know, having a startup is literally like a roller coaster, you know, and that there's nothing better than the highs that you go through, but there's also, you know, nothing much worse than some of the lows. Just, you know, I think just being prepared for the fact that it's not going to be a smooth ride. Whenever I'm down about something, like work-related, I always try and put it in perspective in terms of whether it's issues going on in the rest of the world or whatever. So I was in Vegas last week for a big wedding conference. Definitely recommend going to a wedding conference. So I was there in the shooting.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, there was a sort of... I was busy gambling away at a blackjack table, and suddenly a stampede of people come running through saying they've got guns, they're shooting. So I'm with my brother, so we sort of run with everyone, you know, assuming they're people with guns in the casinos, because no one actually knew what was going on at the time.
You're not going to stop and ask questions at that point.
No, not at all. And I mean, in some ways, the timing wasn't bad for us, because actually we were losing pretty heavily on the blackjack table. So picked up what was left of my chip stack and ran for it. But you know, we got upstairs to the room we were staying in, and you know, we knew we were out there for this conference, really sort of network with some of the big American players. And I was kind of nervous before this conference, but actually that put it into real perspective, going, you know, people are lucky to have their lives, lucky to have food, lucky to have home, family. So keep
a sense of perspective.
Yeah, you know, if I mean, you're always going to be doing things within your role that aren't enjoyable, but you know, there's a lot more to life. You know, sort of getting on with it with a smile on your face makes a big difference.
Yeah, really good advice. I like that. And yourself, George, any advice for startups?
I think the only thing I would say is that, like, any startup founder who's giving advice about their startup is basically saying, here are the numbers that I use to win the lottery. So, like, everything that any startup founder says, you should take with a huge pinch of salt. Unless they've gone and done three startups and they've exited all of them with, like, billion-plus IPOs. Mm. Basically, we're all making it up as we go along. And there's like
there's advice without saying how to be successful. There's advice on just how to deal with the pitfalls and emotional strains.
I think it's so personal. It's such an intensely personal thing to everybody that basically there is a freedom that comes with knowing that every single person around you in the startup community is making it up as they go along, and you shouldn't feel like any kind. You shouldn't be comparing yourself to other people, and if you are getting stressed out by it, like, that's completely normal. But you just have to make, like, an effort to try and learn about yourself and learn how to better manage your emotions. I mean, like, I've tried everything from meditation to jogging, just all sorts of things that I'm shit at and I don't enjoy. And, like, the reality is that it's still going to happen. You're still going to be stressed out, and it's just part of the journey. Like, I'm the worst person to ask about this, because I have almost no advice for people on a pastoral level about anything. Like, I don't understand, like, humans.
The one thing I was going to say, it's big help. I'm guessing it's the same for George, is that. Having a good network around you makes a big difference, not just for the advice, but actually kind of picking you up as well. And I mean, in terms of, if you look at any startup that's been successful, it's not just the actual management team, but just having that network of kind of a support group around you makes a huge difference.
That's really true.
And you know, the great thing is, as a founder, you can choose to you know, take on board what people are saying. You can choose to disregard it as well, but just having you know, all of that feedback coming through. I mean, even from this podcast now, you know, we've never met before, but I've actually taken on a lot of useful things, and that's we're in a unique position because of our roles to be able to sort of network and build out our own networks in that way, and actually sort of share advice and learn. Which
good, yeah. And make time to make that happen. Don't bury yourself away when you've got access to.
That's really true. Network. We had, there's one of the great things about, like, buildings like this, where when we started, we rented Go Cardless's broom cupboard from them. And I had no idea who they were or what they were doing. And in this office building on Finsbury Square at Royal London House, this horrible building they're trying to turn into, I think they've actually turned it into a hotel now, but it was, like, the worst building there. They basically, there was us, there was Smarkets, and there was Go Cardless. And over the course of about 6 months, we were all just, like, living in the office, getting to know each other. All of us raised venture capital. And then from Go Cardless, obviously, Tom's gone and started Monzo. Matt started Nested. Hiroki's still doing Go Cardless. Smarkets have now gone to the US as well as in the UK. We're doing okay. And it wouldn't have happened. Like my attitude four years ago would have been like, networking shit, I hate people, why am I talking to them and everything. And now, you know, you can't join the dots looking forwards, you can only join them looking back. But there's no way that we'd be where we are today without the influence of those companies.
And I bet you any money that one of the reasons you had that thought in the first place, networking shit, is because you'd been programmed to think that networking is those incredibly painful, awkward moments of standing around with a glass of wine, listening to some dickhead talk about his failing business, and you preparing your sentence, not listening to anything he says.
When you came and said to me, when you came to get my attention earlier to ask me to do this, like, the reason I took my sort of, I took my headphones half off and was like looking quite skeptical was because I was pretty sure that what was going to happen was there was going to be something like, we've got some pizza on the ground floor, and like there are going to be some people, you know, some people working on online video, and like there's some people building a content management system, we're all just going to get together, because we actually used to work in a shared office where that sort of thing happened. And they always used to come over to me and say, like, why don't you want to, like, talk to people? And it's because I was incredibly rude and a misanthrope. You're absolutely right. And, like, it's so useful. But I think that the important thing is actually it's not just about networking for the sake of networking. It's about building meaningful relationships with people, like, both kind of who are ahead of you and behind you. You know, there's a great company right next door called Pickfair who are in one of the other ministry buildings. So Benji Lagnardo there reached out to me about getting some advice for something a few years ago. I helped him with something. We've become really firm friends. Last week, I had a shocker of a week in my personal life, which, you know, we're obviously not discussing. But I was able to just come outside from here and just give him a call and say, like, I'm outside. We went for a walk and talked it through, and I felt so much better for it. And that's the kind of thing that is, like, it's not just serendipity. It is also the act of making an effort to give back to the community.
Yeah.
And that was non-obvious to a robot like me.
Oh, wonderful. Well, I think we'll leave it on that. That was amazing. I genuinely noted a lot of that myself. I might have to listen to it back. Normally, I'll just shove this shit into the ether and carry on. Thank you very much. George from Rentified.com. Find out more at Rentified.com. And Robin from WeddingPlanner.co.uk. If you're planning a wedding, then, of course, that's the place to go. Thank you so much. Charlie, for sitting there looking beautiful and being apparently my husband.
Yeah, that was great. Just enjoyed listening to
stories. We both look forward to an invite to the wedding.
Really looking forward to it, yeah. Can't wait to buy you guys a big toaster.
That was Founders Ramble. See you in a couple of weeks. All the best. Ta-ta.
Founders Ramble. Stories from entrepreneurs, how they started, why they started, where they're going next. Brought to you by the Ministry of Startups.